Hello and welcome back to the stress sessions. I've not been here for a little while. I just needed a little break from the podcast and just talking about mental health. And I mean, I've still posted on social media, but I just needed a little break from this because it does take a lot of my time up. It takes more time than a lot of people realize because you have to kind of organize everything. And then my heart just hasn't been in the editing. So I thought, wait till I'm ready to sort of jump back into it. And yeah, so here it is. So this week, I am speaking to somebody that I have admired and absolutely loved when they're on television back in the year 2000. So when the millennium hit, this person won probably the most famous ever reality television program ever, I would say. Probably ever. Love Island might top that now, but probably not. This was the original. This was the OG. And I absolutely loved this guy when he won the first ever series of Big Brother UK. This guy was a normal guy. He was a builder and then he left that behind and turned to reality television. He was just a normal guy amongst some people that really wanted to win. And he won the nation's hearts and ended up winning the first ever Big Brother. So this week I'm speaking to the one and only Craig Phillips, who is bloody brilliant. And I, well, since I started this podcast, I wanted to get Craig on, and he said yes, and it was a really great chat. We talked about lots of different things about, well, so sorry to Rob Beckett and sorry to the Parenting Hell podcast because there is a slight overlap with that one in talking about kids for the first sort of 10, 20, well, no, 10 minutes. It wasn't 20 minutes. It's only a short part of the podcast. But yeah, Craig has recently had a newborn baby, so we were chatting about that a little while. And he also has got another child who's a couple of years old who actually came into the room that he was doing the interview on. So yeah, it was interesting, and but she was lovely. Nellie's lovely. And yeah, it was just a great little chat. And we also touched upon the recent passing away of Nikki Graham, who unfortunately had a eating disorder and has suffered from it for many years. So it was really good to talk to Craig and get his view on a number of different topics with regards to mental health and his mental well-being and what he does to kind of help himself and his little family too. So without further ado, here is the Stress Sessions with Craig Phillips.
Hello.
Hey, Craig, how's it going?
Very good, thank you. Oh, my name's coming up, Jennifer. That's my PA, Jennifer, who set us up. How are you? Okay.
Oh, yeah, really good, thank you. How's your day been?
Not too bad, actually. Not too bad. We've been there. We've done a lot of filming last week, and the last few weeks we've done a lot of filming for Silverland, and we didn't quite finish some of the bits and pieces off. So we've been catching up on doing just some little end shots on there. So it's been a busy one. It's always a busy one.
It's really surreal speaking to you because I watched you as a kid on Big Brother, and it's just a really surreal experience. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. The first thing that I do to kick off all of these is to ask you, what is the one song that puts you in a really happy, positive mood?
Oh, okay. One song that puts me in a really happy, positive mood. Oh, what would I say? I think Nelly the Elephant now, which sounds a bit daft, but I think with having a daughter called Nelly, anytime I hear that song now, it just puts a smile on my face. Not that I ever hear it very often. And then here's a random thing that kind of wouldn't put anybody in a good mood. So, but when Nelly was first born, we had somebody come to the house that taught us a little bit of first aid with newborn babies. You know, if
Oh,
you know
okay.
a horrific thing happens, you know, they maybe stop breathing or choking and things like that, which is very common with young children. So we did this little course and it was fantastic. And you're learning how to do all sorts of CPR and different type of resuscitation, etc. And on one of them, where you're kind of pumping on what you'd pump on an adult's chest, you know, of course, it's a lot smaller, just with two fingers on a little junior. And the lady said to us, and I don't even think she knew our daughter's name because our daughter wasn't in the room when we were doing the course, but she said, if you can think of a song, and she said, the one I always do it to is Nelly the Elephant. And our ears propped up and thought, Nelly the Elephant? Are you saying that because we have a daughter called Nelly? And they said, no, because of the beat going, Nelly the Elephant packed the trunk. She said goodbye to the circus. And it's that kind of timing, what you'd have to do on a child's chest, you know, to try and repeat their heart, you know, if it actually stopped. And it's something that's really stuck in our mind. So on a negative thought, it's that, but, you know, we've touched wood, we've never had to have any emergencies like that. So just that little song now, I've only heard it about 4 or 5 times since Nelly's been born. And it just brings a smile to my face every time.
I mean, obviously I know exactly who you are, but for the listeners who might not know who you are, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name's Craig Phillips. I've been a builder for about 33 years. However, 20 years ago, well, nearly 21 years ago now, I was a contestant on the very first Big Brother back in 2000. I happened to win it. And then since then, we've worked on way more than 1,000 television makeover shows all around the building, construction, DIY, design type of industry.
You're probably the most, I'd say, well-known DIY guy in the whole of the UK and beyond, probably. And I read a piece about, I think it was an interview that you did last year, about you personally think, and I kind of agree, that DIY really, really helps with your mental health. So I think when I read that, I was like, oh, some people are going to be reading this being all pessimistic. Like, a lot of blokes do DIY and kind of go around the house repairing stuff to kind of not speak about their feelings. But your job, that's your job, and you're really, really good at it. So it must be working.
Yeah, do you know what, Luke? What we found, right, as you know yourself, you know, mental health has been an issue. It's always been around, you know. It's just been highlighted at different stages of our lives, of everybody else's lives. And I think this last 12 months with lockdown, it's hit more so, more or less everybody in some degree, whether it's minor, whether it's major, whether people were already suffering, it's exaggerated to that, you know, and it's made it worse, this lockdown. But what we found, and I can generally say this hand on heart, we were doing our DIY, as you know, the wife and I, Laura, we do our Mr. and Mrs. DIY. And what we found was when we were putting little posts out, whether it was just from on our phone, doing bits of maintenance around the house, whether we were doing little bits of DIY in our workshop, we were finding we were engaging with a lot more people. And we kind of thought, okay, well, we're on lockdown, so many people are at home, you know, and they sometimes have been furloughed, so they got a bit of extra money, they want to spend it on their house and do it up. But when we started to really dissect this interaction we were getting across all our social media platforms and our YouTube channels, we found a lot of people were suffering from loneliness, you know, with lockdown. They couldn't communicate with friends and family even. And a lot of people turn to, okay, what can I do to occupy my mind and keep my mind off this very negative thing that's happening outside? You know, even myself, you know, and I'm a very strong character, I was watching the news all the time and I was getting down. It was scaring me, you know, to start with. What was happening around Europe, it was coming our way, it was inevitable. And the wife and I, we were terrified. Likewise with most of the UK, we were terrified. And when we started dissecting all these comments and things that were coming in from our social media, it was all about what's helping us tune off away from this negativity that's happening with a global pandemic, was to try and focus on ourselves, try and focus on the surroundings we're in, whether it's a little house, a little flat, it's a big house or not. And when we all look around at our houses, we all get a bit down thinking the walls need a lick of paint, you know, I'd always needed to do the garden. I can't get to work now for months, so I might as well start doing all of them jobs. And we found that people were suffering a little bit with that loneliness and isolation once they actually got stuck into a little bit of DIY, whether it was just a basic bit of cleaning up, you know, sanding a wall down, doing a little bit of painting, and it brightened that room up, it brightened that wall up. They found, wow, this is working, this is helping me, you know, because I can't get out, I can't socialize, so I might as well do the jobs that I've been putting off forever and a day, because let's face it, any homeowners or even people renting houses we're all guilty of putting jobs off around the house and having that time at home, feeling very lonely and isolated. We just realized this is a great way of keeping our mind busy because, as you know, it is about trying to keep your mind strong, trying to keep focused on doing things. And it is a proven thing when you're doing things with your hands and certainly when you're fixing things that you own or you're doing some sort of, whether it's DIY or building something or a bit of maintenance, when you do it and you do it good, you get a bit of self-satisfaction, a little bit of proudness comes in and you think, you know what? I'm glad I've done that and I feel better for doing that. And once we started to realize that this was helping people who were feeling a little bit down, we thought, actually, it's really right. And we started to tune into it a lot closer and realize that these comments we were getting, we were helping people. So that encouraged us. We felt good about our health, ourselves, that we knew we were helping some individuals who needed one. I mean, we all need a little bit of guidance when it comes to building a DIY around the house, you know. There's always something going wrong. So we thought, well, we're killing two birds with one stone here because we just built our house. We hadn't finished it off. I was a typical builder, Luke, and I was so busy doing everything else, I didn't finish it off. So I had time stuck at home to finish them bits and pieces off. We knew by doing them and putting them out on social, we were helping people. We were encouraging people to give them the know-how how to do it and give them something to do. Because when you've got nothing to do and you're sitting at home around these four walls, that's when things can get at you. That's when your mind can kind of start drifting away into these negative thoughts, you know. So for us, doing DIY, we know it is a really good, we can't say it's a cure for anyone suffering with mental health in any way, but we know for sure if you're feeling lonely and you're feeling a bit down about the surroundings you've had, do it up a little bit. Just get focused on what's around you. Clean up, do a bit of maintenance, get the tools out if you've got them. If you haven't, lend them off somebody and start looking at some of our videos and start doing the very smallest DIY tasks. And then they will build up and you build your confidence up. You get more confidence in doing it. And you look for things to do then around the house. I promise people, once they've done one or two things, they think, right, I'm looking for something else. And if you can change that mindset of feeling lonely and looking at them four walls, and having a purpose, having something to do, and knowing when you've done it, you feel proud about it. I promise you, it really is a winner.
I think as well with your videos, because I've watched some of them, they are some of the stuff that you do is really simple, and it's that a lot of people can do. So I think by setting people those really sort of not easy, but those achievable goals, and then they've got that end product at the end of it, I think it does make you feel good, and it does kind of give you a little positive boost when you've done it. And I think if you've got those goals in your head at the start of the day and then you sort of get it done, you've achieved that, and it does make you feel better, and it boosts your endorphins, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really, really does. And you know, the just the response that we got on social media, and you know, people would send us lots of direct messages actually saying, you know, we were feeling so self-contained and lonely, and having something to do now and giving us that confidence and know-how how to do it, you've really, really helped. And Laura and I were looking, thinking, do you know what? That feels great for us knowing we've really helped some individuals out there.
Tradespeople, like, I mean, I wouldn't class you as a tradesperson because you're like, you're so well known. But with tradespeople, people kind of put them in under the umbrella of they struggle to talk about their feelings. So they put all of their effort and work into their day job. And that's kind of how they channel their feelings. Would you say that that's something that you do, or have you kind of always been able to speak about how you feel and kind of act upon that?
I think it's hard for everybody to speak how they feel, absolutely, whoever they are, you know. If we kind of focus a little bit more on tradesmen, you know, I've been a tradesman kind of all my life, sort of thing, 30 odd years, and yeah, some trades, you know, you've got, when you dissect some of the trades, like your brickwork, your carpentry, your plastering, all your groundwork, that type of stuff, they're usually big stropping men, you know, because it's a heavy industry that they're in. And they're quite big, strong, you know, powerful men who do the work. And I've found them bigger, stronger, powerful men are sometimes a little bit weaker when it comes to speaking about their mind and speaking about how they feel, you know, because they have got that persona, they're tough, hard work men, you know, and they don't want to be looked as being weak in any way, you know. So going back for me, I mean, I think I've always been able to open up and talk about my feelings and who I am and what bothers me, what gets me down. And if I kind of recap back, you know, the before the Big Brother stage, where I run a building company for 10 years and I employed about 30 odd guys on there. And, you know, I was under, how could I say, I was probably under a lot of stress, more stress in them days, because the industry I was in and running the business I was doing, I was only a young man. And a lot of the tradesmen I had working for me were old and more experienced and was sometimes quite difficult to manage, you know, in different ways. So I would come home kind of quite stressed and worn out from it. And for me, my little bit of escape then was I lived in a pub at the time. My mum and stepfather owned a little country pub. I lived in a pub, but I didn't drink. I didn't go down to the pub and kind of have a chat with other people around the bar, which, you know, some people find that's a little bit easier. For me, it was the gym side of things. You know, my little escape was to get to the gym every night, and when I'd be worn out or tired and stressed with my day-to-day, I'd have a little workout. That would help me blow off a bit of, you know, blow off a bit of steam, blow off a bit of anger or a bit of upset, whatever I had that day. Or I'd had that week. And then I found if I was wanting to open up about the problems, it would either be to, you know, my close friends at the time, maybe who I was dating at the time then, you know. So I probably wouldn't, I wasn't the one to talk about my feelings publicly. It would only have been with kind of close dear friends, you know, or girlfriends at the time. And then after Big Brother, because I was kind of catapulted into the spotlight in a way and kind of, thrown right into the media, you know, when I come out that house, I didn't even go home for 97 days. I changed hotel every night. And I was doing interviews morning, noon and night on radio stations, TV programs, chat shows and all that sort of stuff. So for me, I was just very kind of, how do you put it? Put in the spotlight, and you just felt as if every microphone was in your face, every light was on you. So you just feel a little bit, I personally feel a little bit obliged to open up and be honest, you know, about how I was feeling. And, it, you know, in them days, talking 20 years ago, and the people did suffer with their mental health and suffered with loneliness and depression and things, but it certainly wasn't highlighted as much then. So if we, I've got a little visitor just come to see me here. My little daughter, Nelly's just shown up. It's hello, darling.
Famous Nelly.
I'm talking to... Name's hello. Nelly, yeah. Name's Nelly. There you go. Are you going to say hi to Luke?
Hello, Nelly.
Luke can hear you, Nelly. Are you going to say hi?
Oh, God, she looks like she's going to cry.
Yeah, you're a little bit shy, yeah. Oh, she's a little bit lovely. Upset, actually. She got sent home from nursery today. She wasn't feeling too good, and she's had a little ear infection as well. So you've had your medicine, haven't you? Yes, you have. Yeah, so go back to, you know, when I come out of Big Brother, it was not a big topic on radios and live TV shows was I getting asked to talk about my feelings and things. But what I did find was I'd do my interviews, chat about what you were up to, and it was usually media stuff, business-wise, you know, or whatever you were doing on my property side. And then the moment you go off air and the cameras are turned off or the radio stations have gone off air, they would kind of say to us, you know, how are you actually feeling? You know, how are you coping with this very big dramatic change to your life from being a normal everyday builder to all of a sudden being catapulted into the public eye, you know, and having to adapt to the way that world works, you know? And don't get me wrong, it was very intimidating industry I was in. And I said this once in my biography and a couple of interviews about 10 years ago, although I come out of Big Brother, and every day for that 97 days, I went to the most weird, wonderful places, whether it was award ceremonies, you know, on Park Avenue, whether it was having dinner with the Beckhams, whether it was going in a plane with, say, Richard Branson, you know, all these weird, wonderful things. I'd turn up then a shopping centre and thousands of people would be there to get a photo and get my signature, and everyone knew my name and all screaming. I've never felt so lonely in all my life. It was a bizarre feeling that the whole country knew my name. And everywhere I went, I got welcomed so well, treated like royalty. I was chaperoned around by bodyguards, drivers, press officers, TV cameras following me morning, noon and night, which was very flattering. But because I didn't have my close friends and family around me, and it was all kind of business but fun, don't get me wrong, and I'm not complaining about it. It was a great, great experience that will, you know, be in my mind forever. Every night and every day, me going to bed in a different hotel, usually getting about 3 or 4 hours sleep and then up and out again the next morning because the bodyguards had rooms either side. I never felt so lonely. It was a weird, weird feeling. And before Big Brother, I hadn't felt loneliness because, you know, I run my building company in a small village. I had lots of great friends. I had lots of builders work for me. I had lots of customers. I lived in a pub. I wasn't short of people around me to talk to, you know, and socializing things with. And I had a good, close family, only a very small family. But all of a sudden, that change in lifestyle made me feel, wow, I'm really lonely here. I'm really, really lonely. And what I did was I ended up, because I would experience all these weird, wonderful, amazing experiences, but I had nobody really to share them with. All the people around me were kind of paid for to be there, you know. And don't get me wrong, I made great friends with them and still are really good friends with them, Luke, as today, you know. But they were still, you know, they were paid to be there. They were doing their job as much as I was doing my job. And I ended up asking one of my good pals, give up your job, you know, forget it. Come and work for me. I can pay you your money. Just kind of hang out with me, you know, just be my PA. Just, you know, answer me calls, arrange this, that, and the other. Help me carry me bags, you know. I'm checking in out of hotels. We've got about 10 different bags with us, you know. It was a frantic kind of 6 months coming out the house. And I just wanted one of my close friends there to experience it all with me. And then when all the lights are turned off and the cameras are stopped and the radio mics are off, I can look at my friends and go, wow, did that really just happen? You know, I can't believe it. And have that laugh and share that experience, you know. Yeah, it was a really, really funny one.
With Big Brother, it was, with the Big Brother that you was on, the first ever one, I think for you guys that were contestants, there was nothing really to compare it to begin with, was there? So you didn't really know what to expect after you come out the house. And I think because it was the first ever kind of really popular reality TV programme, you were just literally, like you said, shoved into the spotlight and was expected to give all these interviews and say all this stuff and spend all this time away for your families. And I love that you got your friend out to come and see you and spend time with you, because that's probably what I would have done, because it's just nice, isn't it? But is there anything else that you did during that time to kind of help you kind of stay level-headed and kind of keep your mental health good?
I was just trying to, I think what helped me, because a lot of people say to me, you know, why didn't that go to your head? You know, was it stressful, you know, enough where you couldn't take it, you know? And I think for me, Nelly, don't touch my microphone. I think for me at the time, it was helpful because I'd run a business for 10 years and it was quite a tough, hard industry. I was in the building industry. Take that pen out of your mouth, darling. It's dirty. And I think I didn't get kind of, how can you put it? I didn't really get too sucked into it and washed away with it, you know. It was flattering that all these big name celebrities, you know, knew my name and wanted to be my friend and was inviting me to places. Yeah, for me, it was a little bit, just try and keep your feet solidly on the floor. Don't get kind of drawn into it too much. And I got some great advice, you know, from people like poor Barbara Windsor, you know, sadly just recently passed away. You know, she would say to me to things like, Craig, you know, television's a fantastic industry to be in when you don't need it. And I used to think about all these things that people would say and think, well, you know, everyone wants me on their TV programs at the moment. Every chat show I've been on and, you know, every makeover program, I was kind of getting invited on them and stuff. And it was great. But at the back of my mind, I kept always thinking what Barbara and other very successful people said to me, you know, and they were just like, Craig, it could all just end tomorrow. So you can't bank on it. You can't rely on it. So I was just looking at it thinking, well, it is what it is. Make the most of it. Enjoy it while it lasts, because if it ends tomorrow, you know, and I had my building skills, I just thought it's not a problem for me because I'll just go straight back onto the building site and do what I do best and do what I love and just get straight back on site, you know, and carry on doing the building work. So I just had to kind of keep focused on it, that it is what it is, and just enjoy it, make the most of it, and don't rely on it, and don't worry if it doesn't last or if it doesn't end, you know. And we're nearly 21 years in now, Luke, and I struggle getting a day off. I actually do struggle getting a day off, you know, and I'm a strong believer now, and I'm comfortable and confident in myself that if one door closes, another one opens. And that's the way I kind of look at life now, you know. And it's happened to me through the years. We've had contracts with the BBC for many years and done hundreds of programmes, then with ITV and done hundreds of programmes, likewise Channel 4, all the Sky channels. And now we're doing lots more stuff online and there isn't as much TV stuff there for me. And that's cool. That's great for me, you know. And I know a lot of friends, you know, and I didn't mention any of their names. They're successful, famous people in the public eye, from actors to sports personalities. And the moment they haven't got a job on for a month or two and they've got no income coming in, panic sets in. They get themselves down. And it's difficult because they haven't got anything else to fall back on, you know. They're sometimes pigeonholed in that acting role or that character that they play. And they're not going to fit in many other programs. They're too well recognizable for that program they're in. Or if the sports personalities, that they hit their peak and then they come down, of course. And that's down to their age and their performance and their physique and things. So, you know, for me, I say to everyone, whatever industry you're in, or if you're going to go into TV, I get stopped so many times. Craig, I have applied for Big Brother. Craig, I've applied for Love Island. What advice can you give me, sort of thing? You know, and I always say to them, think carefully about doing it, you know, because if you're not headstrong enough for it and you haven't got a backup plan and you're not comfortable about failing or becoming a loser on that program or getting insulted by the press or social media nowadays, if you can't fall back on your existing job, your existing career, don't do it. Walk away from TV, walk away from reality TV, because it can be harsh. It's a real cutthroat industry nowadays, you know, and they look at me quite strange when I say to them, don't do it, you know, when they're asking about Big Brother. This was before it was ended, of course. And they look and say, well, Craig, how can you say to me, don't do it when you've done it? Look how successful you are, you know. And I say, but it was a different world 20 years ago. It really was a different world. And I'm true in saying that.
I mean, with all of social media, like you said, social media has been a game changer, isn't it, in terms of kind of like publicity, like trolling and some really positive stuff like you and your wife do and put on social media, but then there's also some really negative stuff that goes on as well. So it's got its real kind of positives and negatives. And I think 21 years ago when you won Big Brother, it was more about the mainstream press, wasn't it? So it's kind of like you were in all of the national newspapers. Yes. And you were photographed in like different, like I guess like OK magazine and like all, do you know what I mean, like publications like that. So I think you've used social media as a platform for a real positive thing, whereas I think that it's just changed so much over the years. And I completely agree with you there.
Yeah, 20 odd years ago when I come out the house, there was no social media. No, there was no Instagram, Facebook or anything. You know, so yeah, you're right. It was just what was in the press, really. You know, sometimes we had some negative articles in the press, and me personally, I kind of just didn't take it on board, you know. I just thought, and so many people said to me, Craig, what's news today is chip paper tomorrow, you know, and that's kind of the way it was. I think nowadays, bad news, if it gets in the press or on social media, it's instant and it's there forever, you know. And not only is it there forever, when you get a bad article in the press, it's usually one individual journalist that's wrote that article and it's their personal opinion of how they see you or what you've done and they want to portray it. Nowadays, someone will put something up on social media quite negative about an individual who's in the public eye. Whether it's true or not, you could have 1,000, 10,000 comments that everybody else puts their pennies worth in, and all of a sudden that magnifies that article, that particular thing that someone's saying about it. It's a double-edged sword, I think, social media nowadays. When I won Big Brother, I got a place in the Guinness Book of World Records, I think, and in the Who's Who book, because I had about 3.7 million people vote for me on the last night of Big Brother. And I remember having dinner with Tony and Cherie Blair. He was Prime Minister at the time. And they said to me, Cherie said to me, his wife said, Craig, you had more votes than the last general election. Your time in Big Brother, you had more votes than the last general election, and you had to pay 25 pence to vote for me. Where you vote for the Labour Party, it was for free, you know. And now in social media, I mean, I'm a late starter. I only started a few years ago, and I'm a bit of a caveman sort of thing. I'm just catching up sort of thing. And, you know, I only got, you know, 10s, 20 odd thousand people kind of following me on that. And we just topped 100,000 on our Mr. and Mrs. platforms. So that type of following is minute to some of the people today that go on a reality program and come out with 2, 3, 4 million followers and fans. But you know, that two or three million people who are following them, 20-odd% of them could be their enemies and just open up with insults and putting them down and things like that, which I can't imagine what that would be like for their frame of mind, you know, for their own mental state, because I get criticized very smallly for my building work, what I do. And in the building industry, you know, you've got people out there who are kind of quite jealous what I do. And believe me, there's thousands of builders out there better than me and can do the job better than me. And they look at some of my videos and say, Craig, you should have done it like that and you should have done it like this. And sometimes they're right, you know, because when you build a wall, there's sometimes five or six different ways of building it. I build it my way and someone else builds it another way. And I'll get the odd one or two, and it's only a very 1%, you know, out of 1,000-odd comments that will say, oh, that's crap, that you're doing it wrong. So I would say I've got it quite easy. You know, I don't suffer. You know, I'm not in the firing line really for being insulted or anything for what I do. I don't put insults out to anybody out there, you know, but I see some of these young people who are coming off some of these reality programs and I know them, you know, some of them I've met, some I just speak to on social media, and they're getting a tough time, a really tough time. It's affecting them. It's affecting their day-to-day life. They're taking it personally and, you know, they can't sleep at night. They're worrying about it in different ways. Me personally, I think, you know, these social media giants need to put a lot more in place to protect individuals. And what everybody says, every email I write, every comment or quote that I do on my own post or anybody else's, I hold myself responsible for what I say on there, you know, and I think everybody else should do that. Everyone who writes a comment about an individual, and if it's negative or derogatory in any way, insulting or threatening, whether it's the law or the social medias, they should follow that up, and that should be dealt with as it would be if it was face to face in a high street and there was a police officer standing there. They wouldn't tolerate abuse, bullying, racism or anything like that whatsoever. It's not acceptable at all. So it shouldn't be acceptable on social media. And I believe, I mean, this might rant over now, but I believe, you know, they should step in there because it is affecting not just young people as well. It's affecting, you know, middle-aged people, even older people, older than me, sort of thing, on social media. I'll tell you why I started on social media. Many years went by, and I'm you know, a bit of an old fossil now, and I just kept saying, I don't want to do Facebook. No, I don't get everyone chatting away, you know. I'm too busy for it type of thing. But I was going to places, and I was bumping into lots of Big Brother housemates, some of the celebrities in areas and places, and they were saying, oh, Craig, I've been chatting to you on Facebook for a couple of months. Really?
Oh, God.
I say, I've never done Facebook in my life. I said, you know, I don't even use a computer. I have a phone. All I could do is text and phone on it, you know. I said, all my life in my building company and after Big Brother, I'd had a PA who does all my office work and things for me. So it was only up to about 8 years ago before I used the computer for the very first time. And I say to people, it's not me. It's not me. Mm. So I get my PA to look. We'd find this account. They were on Facebook. We find this account. We would write to Facebook to say someone's impersonating me. They're using my pictures. They're doing this. They're saying it. They're chatting to other people, pretending to me. You know, in them days, everything was done online, sort of that you can't talk to anybody personally on Facebook. And they would just say things like, what are they doing? And we'd have this questionnaire. Yeah, they're using pictures. Yeah, okay. Are the pictures, are they, you know, indecent? No. Are they threatening you? No. Are they slanderous you? No. They're talking about what I've done and where I've gone. And so they weren't kind of breaking the laws, but they were still impersonating me. Now, taking somebody's identity. Oh, you've got my little bulldog there waking up as well now. And, you know, they weren't breaking the laws. So it was taking us months and months to get these people off. In the end, you know, on Facebook would say, well, send a photograph. We'd send them my driver's license, passport. A month or two later, we'll get it taken down. 5 minutes later, someone would set another one up and just do the same. And this happened probably about 7 or 8 times. And in the end, Facebook said, look, just open an account up. Get yourself an account, start having a profile, etc. So we did do that. We did it kind of begrudgingly, I don't know, about 5 years ago, maybe a bit longer now, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and then didn't really kind of use it much in any way. And then it's only kind of been more recently, you know, my staff are saying, you've got to have a page now and it's got to be official and get it verified and things like that. So we did that then with Facebook and it hasn't been a problem since.
A couple of the things that you've talked about, so the whole
I mean, if somebody impersonated me, I'd be pretty worried because, like, every day's a one. But but in terms of like that, and then being in the public spotlight, and I mean, being pushed completely out of your comfort zone in on numerous occasions, have you ever felt like kind of anxiety or anything like that around being in those situations, or have you just literally been like, right, I'm going to tackle this. This is me now. I'm going to just go for it.
I think, don't get me wrong, there's been many, many situations where nerves take over and then anxiety starts to bubble your blood up a little bit and get worried about things. But I would say I've been very lucky that I think that experience of coming out of Big Brother, let's say thrown in the deep end, morning, noon and night, having to perform or having to do an interview or up on stage and just given, you know, a bit to award ceremonies, you know, which are live on TV, hundreds of people in the audience, big name people in the audience, and then been on a stage at concerts, and they just give you a microphone and expect you to be able to perform, you know, and it's not easy to go out 10,000 people in an arena. You're given a microphone and, yeah, just go and chat them for a couple of minutes and then we're going to do a song, you're miming it, or you're going to do this, you're going to get interviewed. I was just thrown in at the deep end. So don't get me wrong, you know, that was nerve-wracking at many, many occasions. But I think because it was so often, you kind of build up the confidence, build up immune system to kind of think, well, it's okay. You know, I've done this before. It's just a bigger audience, or there's just more people or more cameras, you know. So just kind of get on with it type of thing. So I would say I was always quite a confident lad anyway. So maybe it's made me more confident. But, you know, there's many times, you know, I'll sit in a hotel the night before trying to think, I've got to get asleep because I know I've got a really important thing to do tomorrow. A lot of pressure on there. And then that pressure gets to the end and you can't sleep. And then it's a vicious circle then because your mind's going over what am I going to do, what am I going to say tomorrow, how it's going to be received. And then all of a sudden you can't get asleep for 2 hours. And that vicious circle is just getting worse and worse for me. So I'd say they're the type of down feelings that I've got when I've had to do certain type of performances, you know. But I think 21 years on now, I kind of think, well, it is what it is. You know, if I mess up, I tell you what's got a good backbone for me is I've done a lot of pantomimes, and I would go on doing these professional pantomimes at Christmas time, and you'd have very talented singers, dancers, actors who are great at what they do. And I would come along and be like sometimes the head of, you know, the top cast or whatever on this thing, only because my profile was bigger than theirs. I'd be getting paid a lot more money than them. And then I'd be thinking, oh my God, I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't act anywhere near as good as them. They're probably looking at me thinking he doesn't deserve this because he's one Big Brother and his profile's there, he's got this role, which is true. That's probably why I got the role. So panic used to set into me thinking, oh God, what are they thinking about me? You know, am I going to mess it up? And what happened was, yes, I did mess it up on stage. You know, I'm only human. I can't act as good as them and I forget my lines and things. But what happened was, I could get away with it because the audience, you'd have 2,000 or 3,000 people sitting there. They knew I wasn't a professional actor, singer or dancer. So the more I messed it up, the more laughs it got. So it worked. It kind of went in my favor. So all of a sudden after doing, you know, you do your first pantomime run, it's 50 odd shows, whatever. You get past about the 10th, 15th show. You're comfortable with what you've got to say. You know where you mess up. You know it gets laughs, so then you start playing on it. So the more I messed up and got it wrong, the funnier it became, and it worked. So all of a sudden, I didn't have them anxiety feelings of panic setting in, got to get it right, you know, and I wasn't adding that extra pressure onto me, you know. And I think once you can overcome in your mind that it doesn't matter what you do or how you perform, if it's wrong, as long as you're doing your best, if it's wrong and it gets laughed at, not in a... you know, laughed at in a funny type of way, it's not a problem. We're all human. We all make mistakes. The general public will probably see it more genuinely that you're just human and go along with it, you know. And it helped me. It really, really helped me from doing them live performances on stage when you've got, you know, two or 3,000 people sitting there all like that watching you live and big follow spots, you know, big bright lights on you.
I think that's why you've done... So you've been so successful in your career though, because you have just been you. You haven't put on a front and been somebody that you don't want to be. I think you've done that during Big Brother, probably before Big Brother. I don't know that period, obviously, and after. So I think that's why people because you're such a likable guy. You are a really kind of down to earth, likable guy. You are though, and it's. I think that's going back to what you said earlier with when you had dinner with Tony Blair and his wife Cherie, and they said, "Oh, you got more votes on Big Brother." That's why, because I think the country resonates with you, and it's testament to yourself for doing that. Because, I mean, if you kind of put yourself up against people that go on reality TV programs now, they have like a game plan or they have like an idea in mind of what they want to get out of it. Whereas you just went in there and was just you. So I think that's why it worked.
Yeah, I think, well, we've been on the very first one, you know, I didn't have any expectations. I didn't really know what was going to come out of it. And, you know, and it wasn't really going on for me. And generally, hand on heart, I didn't want to become famous. I had no ambitions to be famous, work in the public eye in any way. I was happy and content. Running a building company was hard and it was stressful. But the fantastic opportunity came my way. Big Brother, you know, catapulted into... The size-wise, you know, it was way bigger, their expectations, than what they, Channel 4, all the production team, Endemol, Basil Productions, all what they were expecting. It super exceeded all of that, you know. So I got this weird, wonderful opportunity to, you know, take the whole bull by the horns and run with it type of thing. But I remember chatting with many, you know, famous, real successful people like your Robbie Williams and then type of characters who, you know, and conversations with them when I first met them, they'd spent their life building up. And working so hard to get their profile where it was and getting knocked down on the way and all the upsets to try and finally get as big as somebody like Robbie gets and has been and still is, you know. And then me, overnight, all of a sudden, I was on par with them, you know. I was getting just as much press attention as them. I was recognised as much as them. I was probably doing more radio stations and interviews than them in that first 3 months of coming out of Big Brother. You know, a lot of them were jumping on my publicity and my kind of bandwagon at the time. I didn't realise. I thought they were just all being my friends. But now I realise now how the publicity well works, you know. It was great, you know. I had Chris Evans wanting to give me £50,000 to support our appeal for Joanne Harris. The Beckhams giving me money to Richard Branson. You know, all these super famous, successful people coming forward, wanting to be my friends, wanting to spend time with me, wanting to support Joanne's appeal. But, of course, they were doing that, and then they were on the front page of the newspaper the next day. Mm.
There's one question that I really want to ask you, but... Feel free not to answer it. And I've left it towards the end because I'm a little bit nervous to ask it. But your fellow contestant, Nikki Graham, sadly took her own life quite recently after struggling with an eating disorder. And I think she suffered for quite a number of years. And I think eating disorders aren't really fully understood by a lot of people. And there's a lot of campaigning around mental health at the minute, and rightly so. But what do you think we personally need to do to kind of make it easier for people to talk about their mental health? Oh, is it?
Are you coming to visit? Are you coming to sit on my knee again? I'm still chatting with you. Okay, now I'm going to answer the question. Yes, you know, eating disorders are an hugely, majorly problems, you know, for young women and men. You know, even my wife, you know, my wife has had troubles in the past before and really dark thoughts, you know, about her appearance and, you know, what she eats and things like that. And she's quite well educated, you know. On food and on training and things. She's been a personal trainer in her life, and it still has got the better of her, you know, at times. So for many young people who are, let's say, caught up in social media and how they feel they're supposed to look and how they feel about themselves with looking at themselves, how it makes them feel mentally is a dangerous and a sad kind of... Mm. Sad predicament, you know, we find millions of people in, you know, which is really, really scary. And, you know, poor Nikki, who, you know, Nikki Graham was a friend of mine I worked with for many, many, many times over the years. It's heartbreaking. And I don't really know what the answer is, if it was to be honest, Luke, because there isn't a quick fix and there isn't a quick cure to that. I personally, I've never suffered with... about how I look, you know. I'm a very short guy. I'm only like 5'7", you know, and I've had a few people make jokes and laugh at me being small, but I'm confident it doesn't bother me, you know. It really doesn't bother me. I'm fit and healthy inside and outside as well, you know. So I've just got on with it. But I've never suffered with any form of eating disorder. You know, I've been very fortunate that way. So I can't honestly say hand on heart with how that feels. But learning a little bit more from how Laura has explained about how she's felt and the industry that she's worked in both media and in training and physical side of things is, you know, she's explained to me in quite depth about how it can affect you and get a grip of you and tell your mind, you know, what's happening, how you look. And, you know, a lot of the time this is wrong. These, you know, beautiful, let's say girls, you know, young girls who are suffering with anorexia and other eating disorders are looking at themselves and thinking they're overweight and they're not acceptable and they don't look good. And the reality of it is they're not overweight. They're in fact underweight, you know, and their internal organs are sadly getting affected by them neglecting themselves. But I think I'm probably wrong in saying this and I'm not qualified to say it, but my initial thought would be, are we not educated enough? You know, should this be down to our schools to try and educate these young girls who may be a bit vulnerable and young men, you know, maybe a bit vulnerable about how they physically look? You know, should there be more things more things in the way to stop people looking at social media and getting drawn into, you know? But you know what? It's not, it is social. Well, I can't just say it is social media. Social media is playing a big part in it. We all know that, you know. But even before social media, you know, I can remember all the magazines and things like that, you know, who would only want these, you know, supermodels in there who had to be stick thin and had to look a particular way. And that was going on for decades, Luke, in magazines, you know, before the social media come about. So it isn't social media's complete fault. Again, they just magnify things. It has been around for a long, long time, you know. And I feel that maybe our schools should be a little bit more aware of, maybe they might be, I don't know, I'm a bit out of touch, you know. Maybe if they could be a bit more responsible for explaining to the young children in there about diets, about what is right and wrong to eat, and about what is acceptable and how you should look, you know. But I suppose that's difficult because then you're trying to say this is a particular, you know, a perfect way of looking or an acceptable way of looking. Because, you know, I know I've got friends who are, it's probably the wrong word of me actually saying, are overweight. You know, and a doctor would actually say that they are overweight for their height, size, and their mass of how they look. But they're very happy, confident within themselves. They do a little bit of training. They eat comfortably. They eat out and they eat good stuff and they eat bad stuff as well. Me and my wife, we're quite educated about what's good and what's bad to eat. You know, we try to feed our child. Well, not only Nelly, the young Lennon is still on baby milk at the minute. Well, still on boob milk at the minute. But, you know, we know what's good and bad to eat. We know how we can keep ourselves fit. We know how we can look after ourselves. But we still eat junk food, only a small minority of it. But we feel as if we get the balance right to try and make ourselves enjoy life a little bit more and be comfortable about what we eat and drink, you know. So we're not that strict on it that way. If I was going a lot more overweight, or if my wife was going a lot more overweight, we would then focus on what we are eating. We'd curb the junk food we were eating, and we'd focus a little bit more on fitness because that's our background we've been on. Where a lot of young people haven't had that experience that we've had of the fitness and the dietary side of things, so they wouldn't know what to do. So I believe our schools should invest and dedicate a lot more into how to make your body healthy, what you eat and what level of training and fitness you should do. You know, and I believe anyone's acceptable in whatever way they look, how big or small that they are, is acceptable in my eyes. I don't judge people on what they look like. So it's a real tough one because, you know, going back to, you know, poor Nikki again, I haven't seen Nikki or spoken to her. I think I put a post up on my Instagram with the last time I seen her was on a chat show with her. I think it was on the Lorraine Kelly show I was on with the last time. And I remember going into the green room and it was early in the morning. There was four or five other people in the green room. So I was a bit half asleep and the person there chaperoning me around just took me in and was like, just teas and coffees over there and help yourself to that. Producers will be with you, you know, in another half an hour or an hour or so. And they kind of said, oh, and Nicky's over there. And I kind of glanced my eye over there, and Nicky has always been very small and petite, you know. And I kind of glanced my eye and was probably half not listening to what the lady was saying. I was more looking at the food that was there than the coffee because I was starving. And I just kind of half heard Nicky, and I glanced my eye across, and I generally didn't recognize her. I generally didn't recognize poor Nicky, you know. And it took a bit of a heartbeat, and I grabbed a cup, and then I kind of heard Craig. So then I turned, looked, and I kind of seen Nicky, you know. I was like, hello, my lovely, you know, when I give her a big hug and a kiss, and we had a good catch up, you know, and a good chat and things. But, you know, bless her, she was very small and she was very frail there. And over the years, I'd seen Nicky go a little bit up and down in her weight, you know, and kind of, you know, she's gone through, you know, good and bad times of her life, you know, and it had been affecting her. I generally didn't know at what level it got to recently with Nicky, because, you know, I hadn't actually been in touch with her. But it's sad and it's shocking, and I believe there should be more support there for helping. And, you know, this pandemic has put everything behind, you know. The NHS, yes, have been overstretched in many ways. However, this is just my personal opinion, I'll probably get in trouble for saying it, you know, the NHS have also made many savings in lots of areas by not doing hundreds of thousands of major, major operations, you know, for people who've suffered with other illnesses like Nicky and many, many others. I can only well imagine, in all sorts of illnesses, haven't had the treatment and have declined rapidly because of that, you know. And it's very, very sad. It's a sad state of affairs that this is how our country has become and got into, you know. And more money, more resources have to be put aside, have to be dedicated to it, because all these illnesses, like Nicky's and many, many other people out there, this is an emergency. This is an emergency that's been building up and creeping up over years, Luke, over decades, and it needs to be addressed. It needs to be addressed fast.
I totally agree with everything you just said, by the way. So, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with education in schools. I think that kids, not at a too young age, so not like when they're in primary school, but maybe when they move into secondary school from maybe 10, 11 years old onwards, do need to be taught about mental illness and the different types of mental illness and eating disorders and depression. Because at that sort of age, you could start kind of developing an illness, I think. But
that's right. That's where sometimes the root of the problem can stem from.
Yeah.
You know, at that young age, just turning into teenagers, you know. So I think you're right. The more education that you can give a child of what potentially could be a problem, I suppose then it could be more identified a little bit quicker, you know, before it does escalate and get out of hand. And hopefully, whether it is the school, whether it's the parents or some other department, let's say, that has to step in and intervene and advise or care for and guide them down the right route, or guide them down a solution that can help them and not let it get out of hand, because, you know, it can escalate a couple of years down the line, and then all of a sudden that small problem has become a big problem and it's not easy fixable, and sometimes it may not be fixable, you know.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Phone calls or text messages?
Phone calls for me.
City break or beach holiday?
Beach every time.
Bath or shower?
Oh, I enjoy a bath, but I have showers every day. I probably only have a bath about once a month, but I probably enjoy a bath, more.
Plan ahead or take each day as it comes?
Take each day as it comes.
A good book or a good film?
A film. Yeah.
The morning or the evening?
Evening.
Oh, that's interesting. Everybody said the morning so far, so that's really interesting. Yeah.
You know what? I used to, when I was on my building site, the 10 years before Big Brother, I was an early bird. So I would always be up at the crack of dawn, planning what all my boys were going to be doing, organising things, etc. So then when my lads arrived on site 7:30, you know, I'd already be up working for a good hour and a half. So I was always in early bed. Now, well, just my office is in the house, my studio's just the other side of the house there in my workshop. So I can just get up and roll in at any time I want. So I find myself kind of my wind down time is when I stop working. I'll put the kids to bed. We'll start bathing them around about 6 o'clock, get them to bed, settle down for 7:30. Laura and I will have our main meal then. We'll have a little glass of wine. I sit and watch a bit of TV sometimes with Laura, only till about 9:30 now. And with obviously the newborn, Laura will take him to bed because she's getting up and feeding him and things through the night. And I'm not, I'm just looking after Nelly. So sometimes I'm getting a good night's sleep through. So what I will do is I'll either come in the office and catch up on some work then when the staff aren't around, or I'll sit down and then start watching a little bit on Netflix or a nice movie or something. So I get my wind down time then from about 10:30 up until kind of about 12:30. So I'm starting to become a bit of a night owl now than the early bird.
And this one is for you specifically. So chilling on the sofa or home DIY projects?
Chilling on the sofa for me.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I do home DIY projects kind of every day anyway, you know, and yeah. It's kind of, although it is my job, I do what I want, and we do what videos that we know is going to help other people, you know. It's kind of quite fun and social for me anyway, you know. It is kind of a bit of a stress relief. I like building things. So I think if I'm doing that, sometimes it can be 8, 10, 12 hours a day. Certainly when we're shooting, when we're doing videos here, you know, we can be doing it 10, 12 hours a day. So for me, the chill out time, put my feet up on the couch and enjoy it.
That's fair enough. I'm exactly the same. But then again, I love doing a bit of home DIY as well, because Yeah, it's just nice. I mean, you can probably see in the background, this door, the only thing that's done in this room is the door. It's terrible.
So.
Yeah.
Well, we got plenty of videos online. Luke, how you can paint that up. Yeah. With some French heat paint.
Thank you so much for coming on, Craig. And
pleasure.
I've been a fan of yours for years. You know that, since I was 11 years old. So, yeah, 21 years ago.
That makes me feel old now, Luke. Thanks for that.
No, you're still all right. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
You've been a pleasure to speak to, and thanks so much for being so open as well, because you've discussed a lot of really hard-hitting topics, I think.
Oh, good. Absolutely my pleasure, Luke. Glad to chat with you, mate. It's been really nice to meet you. Good luck with all your podcasts and with everything. Hopefully we'll chat again soon. We may be doing a podcast soon. We'll invite you on as one of our guests.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I'm well up for that.
definitely. Oh, lovely to talk to you too as well then, mate. Take care, and thanks, good luck,
Craig,
with it all.
Well, that was it. That was episode 11, series 3 of the Stress Sessions with Craig Phillips, and as you can probably tell, I really enjoyed speaking to Craig, and apologies to both anybody listening to that and to Craig for massively fanboying him probably the whole time. But I just remember when I was, it was as a teenager, and like Craig was, I think I said at the start of the podcast, he was just a normal kind of guy. And at that point, celebrities were such kind of like a big influence on every teenager's life at that point. So it was just really nice to see a normal guy succeeding in life and kind of doing what he was really good at doing. And yeah, what a great chat. I really wanted to put that one out there, and sorry it's taken so long, because it was a really enjoyable chat. We got to talk about lots of different things with regards to mental illness, and yeah, that was a really, really good one. Thanks for listening. And just as a little reminder, I am not an expert in mental health or speaking about mental illness. All of the stuff that I talk about is from my experience and from the experiences of my guests. So if you do suffer from a mental illness and you do want to speak to anybody, and I would probably recommend getting professional help, because I'm always happy to listen, but it's always worth getting somebody that actually knows what they're talking about rather than just talking about their experiences. So I've actually saved a link within the podcast notes which will take you through to a lot of helpful contacts and links that you of companies, charities that you can get in contact with and seek some help. But if you are suffering in silence, please don't. Please reach out. Please talk to somebody, because there is always somebody out there to listen. There's actually one more podcast in this series, and I'm going to be speaking to, as you'll probably already know if you follow me on social media, at Stress Sessions on Instagram, the lovely Sam Cushing, who is really, really big in the US. It's lovely to chat to. It's a really great one to end the series on, because it was interesting. Well, you'll have to listen to it, but the beginning of the podcast was basically me and him kind of trying to suss each other out, because he was quite nervous about speaking to me, and obviously because he's quite a big sort of figure in America, I was quite kind of scared to speak to him, as I am in every podcast. So we kind of got that out of the way quite quickly, because we were both quite upfront about it, and it turned into a really good chat. And yeah, it's a really, all of these are really, really good chats, but that's a good one as well. So make sure you download that, and I will speak to you again next week for the last podcast from the Stress Sessions of the series. I'll catch you then. Bye.